Today it's my great pleasure to have with us in the studio one individual that I've spoken with before, who I thought very highly of, so I was very happy to bring her back, and another individual who I am just meeting. The first individual is Mary Cerullo, who is an award-winning author of 21 nonfiction children's books on the ocean, as well as a handbook for teachers on using children's literature in the science classroom. Her latest book is Shark Expedition. Mary is the Associate Director of Friends of Casco Bay and has over 40 years' experience as a science translator. As such, she has interpreted marine issues for the general public and for marine user groups through the New England Aquarium, the Maine New Hampshire Sea Grant College Program, the Great Bay National Estuarine Reserve in New Hampshire, and the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Thanks for coming back in, Mary.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Ivy Frignoka is the Casco Bay Keeper. Before her role with Friends of Casco Bay, Ivy worked with the Conservation Law Foundation on issues facing Maine's marine waters. She served as the Ocean's Clean Water and Clean Air Advocate throughout New England. Her professional experience also includes teaching marine biology and ecology, interpreting natural history, designing policies to protect and promote Vermont state parks and forests, and advocating for stronger environmental protections for Lake Champlain. Thanks for coming in for the first time, Ivy.
Thanks for having me.
And you and I, of course, know each other because many moons ago, I knew you when you were a student at the University of Maine School of Law.
Yes.
Yes, which was actually because we were looking at the picture of my son who was 22 and he was a baby when you graduated. So that's like two decades ago. You and I know each other from that long ago.
Thanks for sharing that information with the public.
Well, but you know, you were just a baby when you went through. So obviously you're still quite young. And I'm actually really glad to have the both of you in because I think Friends of Casco Bay is doing such great work.
Thank you.
We know that, Mary, you came in and you spoke with us before about what was happening. And Ivy, you hadn't yet joined, but you were on the horizon. So I'm really happy that you came in and decided that you could spend a few minutes with us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So you went from the Conservation Law Foundation to this role as the Casco Bay Keeper. What was the draw for you?
Well, the draw was, in my prior job, I worked all over New England on a variety of issues. My passion is the ocean and water quality issues. And the particular draw is this is a once-in-a-lifetime position. It's a vocation to be a water keeper, not just a job. And it was a huge draw to work for Friends of Casco Bay. It's an incredible team of educators and scientists, and to be in-house working with them so that anything that I was advocating for was informed by our science, or we could look at issues and then develop our science protocols. And I get to work with people like Mary to reach out to the public and educate people about the issues that we're working on. Just everything was a draw, basically, about the position.
Well, I can certainly understand why you'd want to work with Mary, because I think she's quite wonderful as well. I'm interested in the work specifically that, because we're now, it's springtime, we're heading into a season where people are starting to think about perhaps their landscape. I'm interested in what you're doing with lawns and safe lawns.
We have had a program, I'm almost embarrassed to say, for 18 years now called Bayscaping, trying to get people to reduce dependence on fertilizers and pesticides. And we've, as Ivy said, the research we're doing has backed up the fact that, you know, nitrogen from fertilizers that, and other sources, when it washes into the bay, it creates real problems because it like on land, it fertilizes the green stuff in the ocean, some of which comes out onto the bays and coves is this green slime of algae. And when that algae dies, it not only uses up the oxygen as it decomposes, it also puts in carbon dioxide into the water, which is actually making our mudflats, our shallow water areas, more acidic, which is hard on shellfish. And we've also tested for pesticides as they enter the bay and found it all around Casco Bay going into the water. So our position has been, let's keep it out of the water, trying to give people alternative ways of taking care of basically their lawns, because things wash off the lawns more than off your gardens or, you know, under the duff, under trees. So That has been an ongoing program. We give workshops and materials and things like that. But after 18 years, you know, the use of lawn chemicals really has decreased very little. Now, communities are taking it into their own hands. There's all these citizen groups that are advocating for ordinances. Places like Harpswell, which just passed at its town meeting an ordinance restricting the use or banning the use of neonicotinoids, the bee-killing chemicals, banning spraying near the shore, and the use of fertilizer and pesticides in the shoreline zone. South Portland just had a first reading for its ordinance, which is going to be a sweeping ban on the use of pesticides, and then they're going to get to fertilizers after that, but they're going to ban it. I'm pretty sure it'll pass first after a year of education. They'll ban it on public properties, including their municipal golf course, except for their tee areas, because they really haven't come up with a way of dealing with keeping those greens weed-free and perfect for putting yet. But they're going to work on it. The year after that, they're going to ban it on private property. And then a year after that, make sure that all these things are working. And they've tried to include all sorts of ways of dealing with issues as they arrive, so that people will adapt, will first be educated, adapt, and then they'll adapt the ordinance as it goes. So it's really going to be an interesting ordinance, which I think a lot of other communities are already looking at for themselves.
Ivy, you've spent time in Vermont as well, and you've done work with Lake Champlain. What do you see as the, I guess, similarities and differences between the two states?
Are you asking me with respect to the water quality issues that I've worked on?
Yeah, water quality and environmental issues.
So I'm going to focus on my work with Lake Champlain and with Casco Bay. One of the big similarities is that Lake Champlain is now an impaired water body, and it's listed with the federal government as a water body that's not meeting water quality standards. And that's because of all the nutrients that have been loaded into it. And in freshwater, it's phosphorus, that's the fertilizer. In saltwater, like in Casco Bay, it's nitrogen. So there's a parallel in the issues that we're dealing with in terms of how do we reduce the sources of these fertilizers that are getting into the water bodies and impairing them for the uses that they're naturally intended for and the uses that people make of them. The difference is that in a freshwater body where you're not dealing with tides, you're not dealing with influxes of waters with different types of salinity, you can measure what's going on and craft solutions in a more straightforward manner. And I'm not saying that it's easy solutions. It's not an easy solution in Vermont because a lot of the fertilizers are coming from farms and they're trying to figure out affordable ways for farmers to deal with reducing the runoff that's contributing to Lake Champlain's demise. Here, our scientists, we're grappling with, okay, where is this nitrogen coming from? What happens when you have more fresh water carrying more into the bay? What happens when the level of salinity changes? How is it impacted with rising sea level and rising temperature of the salt water? It's just so very, very complicated, the science and what we're trying to do, that one of the best solutions that we can come up with, which is simple, is to reduce the nitrogen going into the bay in the first place. We know it's bad, and trying to measure how bad it is or where it's having the worst impact is just a much more complicated scientific equation.
Now, obviously, you focus on Casco Bay because you are friends of Casco Bay. But we do have a large number of freshwater sources throughout the state. We have Sebago Lake just in southern Maine, for example, but we have lakes, we have rivers. And so there is actually an impact, and I'm sure that there must be a connection between what's going on inland and what's going on out here when you get to the end of the river, say, as it empties out into the bay. What are you doing about that?
So I'll answer, and then if Mary has anything to add, I'll like to make sure she has an opportunity to answer too. So there's there's two things that we do as an organization. First off, we look at what's going on in the entire watershed. So your question was really astute, because we are talking about what are all these different inputs and what's going on. Because we are a limited staff, sometimes we address those watershed-wide issues by being part of partnerships or coalitions with other organizations who have focuses in different parts of the watershed, so that we can work together, not duplicate work efforts, and make sure that together as teams we're doing the best job to clean the water for everyone in the watershed. And we do the same thing up and down the coast, because as you can imagine, Casco Bay is just part of the coast of Maine, and so many of these issues affect all of coastal Maine. So we have partnerships with other organizations up and down the coast, and one of the most exciting right now is a partnership that we put together with a couple other nonprofits called the Maine Ocean and Coastal Acidification Partnership, where we're working with researchers up and down the coast to fully understand coastal acidification and what we can do to protect our shellfish populations. Mary, do you want to add anything to that?
I was just saying, you know, talking about partnerships, we have a really large, well-trained core of water quality monitors who are volunteers. And to your point, where they have found the highest concentration of nitrogen coming into the bay is at those river mouths. So that tells us that the sources are coming from land. So it's not only professional associates that we work with, but these citizen scientists are a big part of our program as well, which is, I think is really unique and pretty exciting that people who aren't scientists can actually contribute data that is used by the state, by other researchers, actually submitted to Congress as part of our Clean Water Act requirements. So yeah, it's a great coalition.
I have some significant worries about what pesticides do to human health. So I think it was probably 10 years ago I wrote an op-ed for a local paper about pesticide use on playing fields. And it was interesting because a few people would connect in and say, oh, I've been thinking about that, but not many. And mostly it was just sort of a vast silence. And it's good that I guess nobody was fighting with me, but on the other hand, it feels like now people are really willing to engage. Now there's not that vast silence. Now people are finally saying, okay, yeah, maybe we should be careful about pesticide application because our children are going to be playing on these fields, or we're going on a golf course. We're going to be on these golf courses ourselves. So what do you think has shifted? I mean, I don't know. Maybe you have you seen the same thing in your organization?
I've seen it in this bayscaping program. Scarborough was one of the first communities to control the use of pesticides, only organic pesticides on playing fields. The new ordinance that's being proposed for South Portland specifically includes athletic fields. And there was a big discussion about that because coaches will say, well, you know, you could have a hole in the ground, somebody's going to fall and trip over weeds or into the hole and break their ankle. So there is the side of how to make it safe for players. But I think more people realize now that rolling around on pesticides is probably not a good idea. So there is an awareness, but it's coming from a groundswell of community members that I think is really exciting. I think in the next couple of years, we're going to see some really big changes in regulation of pesticides, especially for athletic fields and playgrounds.
I think what's interesting about listening to your question and Mary's response is that when you were first raising this concern, people were just beginning to really think about this issue. Who knows why at that particular time. And over a very short period of time, there has been more scientific data collected, even including our own data out in the bay, just taking a snapshot of where pesticides are entering the bay, so that rapidly the public has become much more aware that even though we live in a state where we think we're in this totally clean environment, that these are real threats and they want to do something about it. And I think that's what's so terrific about working for an organization like Friends of Casco Bay. We can identify the issues, we're located on a region, we can collect the data so that whatever action's taken, it's taken based on on good factual information and can really have an impact. So it's pretty exciting to see these efforts going on in the communities that are around Casco Bay.
And to that point, it's really interesting. There is an organization that's Washington, D.C. based, advocating for removal of pesticides all over the country. They're having their national forum here April 15th and 16th at Hannaford Hall at USM in Portland as a result of the ground, you know, the advocacy that's been happening here for the last couple years, which we found really exciting that they're going to bring in all these national experts and have a discussion. And our point is to include people like landscapers, arborists, others who work in the industry as part of the conversation. We have a real collaborative approach, which sometimes separates us out from other organizations, but we want to put everybody into the conversation. And I think that, you know, whatever is created as a result is a lot more responsible, and I know a lot of communities are trying to do that as well.
Mary, I think that that approach is a better one, because I know that when I initially was doing research on this, and when I got my master's in public health, which was just, you know, a little bit more than 15 years ago, there was, although some of the research was there, it was early, and some of the people who were talking about it were more extreme, which of course happens. People who are kind of the alarmists, they need us all to know that this stuff is happening. So it's very real, and what they're saying isn't wrong. It just doesn't necessarily generate a lot of collaborative efforts, I'm guessing. So what you're talking about is really trying to bring the people in together and say, let's all work on this problem, as opposed to, we're going to tell you what you're doing wrong, and we're going to tell you how to fix it, because not too many people love to have that sort of thing thrown at them.
I think what's kind of hard is, and let me talk about a current example. We know that microbeads, the type of small beads of plastic that are in facial scrubs and toothpaste, are out in Casco Bay. And this is an issue upon which we're one of the first sounding an alarm, if you will. But we can't recommend what to do about it yet, because we're just looking at, we know it's a problem. We supported the state ban on microbeads. We're thrilled that there's now a federal law that bans them nationwide that will go into effect over the next several years. But now we're looking at, how do we do the research to actually look at how many microbeads are in the bay, what types of plastics are out there, and how they're impacting us? At the same time, we can say, we know it can't be good. It doesn't seem like it's good for us to know that we're eating this. We know it's not good for some marine organisms based on a few preliminary studies that other organizations have done. So I think it's pesticides is 10 or more years ahead of where microplastics is. And microplastics is now one of those new emerging issues where we can talk, but we can only still talk in generalities. And as you get that advancement of science, then you can make these informed decisions. And in the meantime, you have to do something, because you know in the end, you're going to find out, oh, it's really not good to eat plastic. It's not in one of the four food groups.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I know when Mary was on here last time, she was talking about microfibers as a result of synthetics. And after that, I stopped washing my pullovers quite as often, because I couldn't figure out what else to do. I didn't want to throw away my lovely fleece pullover that I use to get warm after I run, but I didn't put it in the washing machine quite as often. And I didn't buy any more after that. You know, so I think exactly what you're saying is true, that you want to do something if something is going on that's not helping your health or the health of the environment, but sometimes you don't know what that is yet.
Right, and we try to be pragmatic in that, you know, just doing what you're doing is a step in the right direction. You know, you can't change your whole lifestyle, you know, at one fell swoop, but once people know what the problem is and start taking steps to fix it, you know, that's Maine. That's the, you know, with a collaborative approach that everybody seems to want to take anyway. We're all here because it's a great environment. We want to protect it. But also said, there are so many things that we are still working to learn more about. And for example, with pesticides, there's one that was used to kill mosquitoes in Long Island Sound. you know, further south, not our area. And, you know, now even the state of Maine is looking into these chemicals, pyrethroids, to see what the long-term effect could be for our shellfish, especially our lobsters, because it really had a hand in damaging the lobster fishery there, although warming waters is still the biggest problem.
So that's an interesting example of something that I grapple with, because we spray pesticides because we don't want mosquitoes, because mosquitoes spread illnesses. It used to be malaria, and now we've got Zika virus, and we've got all kinds of fun things that are cropping up. So we know that if you don't have a way to deal with organisms that are causing disease, then you cause human health problems. But now you're causing health problems by spraying this pesticides. So I grapple with that. I grapple with the fact that, you know, we now know that people are flushing into the ocean the results of their prescription drugs that they are taking a lot of. So we've got birth control pills floating around in the waters that somebody will end up ingesting that. So you see what I mean? There's an interesting balance, like health and health.
And there are many interesting balances. And I think when I listen to this dialogue, a couple things come to mind. First is how important it is that we're now aware of these things. Because if you don't know that it's getting to the ocean when you flush it down the toilet, if you think you're doing the right thing by responsibly getting rid of extra medicine that you don't want around the house, but you don't know it's causing another harm, then you can't stop and make another choice about it. And I think the same thing with fleece. I find the fleece debate really hard, because if you're wearing a product or clothing that's made from recycled plastic, and that's such a good thing, and I don't know about you, but I have fleece that is older than my children, because the fabric lasts and lasts and lasts. Well, that's a good thing. I'm not going out and buying new products all the time. So I can't say, oh, suddenly my fleece is bad. I would also have practically nothing to wear. I have my dress fleece and my my play fleece. So what do we do about that? Do we look at supporting companies that can design filters for our washing machines? Do we look at supporting companies like Patagonia that are looking at playing with different length fibers so that our fleece won't shed? And I think these are all just incredibly complicated questions. And as we gather the science, it's so important to have the conversations and make decisions that are not easy. These are not black and white decisions. Killing someone, that's bad. That's black or white. You know, I guess even in war, you could say it's never completely black and white. But so many of these environmental decisions fall in gray areas between competing harms and competing goods. It's pretty tricky.
Well, I know as a doctor, I'm not one to willy-nilly prescribe medications. And in part, I'm thinking about the long-term health of the patient. Do they really need an antibiotic? You know, do they really need to use birth control pills, or is there another option for them? You know, I'm always trying to balance the long-term, their short and long-term health, but I'm also thinking, you know, the more people we load up with medications, the more medications get peed out into the water, the more medications get flushed down the toilet, and the stuff just, it's just this vicious cycle. So it's an interesting and weird place to be existing. Like, you know enough to feel a little concerned, but you don't know quite enough to know where to go next. But that's what you're working on.
Right, because yes. We don't want people to be stuck at the guilt phase.
No, of course not.
It's nice to have some solutions. But what I like about our organization is we do marry the science and the advocacy and the outreach. And I think that's a good three-pronged stool to have at our disposal, where we try to raise the issues, but we try to base them on science, and we try to give people solutions as much as we can.
Ivy, you're only the second baykeeper, is that right?
Technically, I'm the third. Joe Payne retired in December of 2014, and the executive director for Friends of Casco Bay served as the interim baykeeper during the search term, and then I came on board as the third baykeeper.
I would assume that the baykeeping role is one that continues to evolve.
Absolutely.
And what does it involve now? What are you going to be focusing on in the foreseeable future?
I have two really big goals, and this will, I'm sure, span over the entire time that I'm Baykeeper, and I hope to hold this position for quite a long time. The first is the city of Portland has struggled for years with excess stormwater running into the bay and carrying with it raw sewage when there's overflows. And that happens every month, or still almost every month there are episodes where that still occurs. And so I feel very strongly that it's one of my missions to continue working with the city. They're under a court order to clean this up. They've been under that court order since 1991. It's an expensive and difficult process, but the problem in some ways is exacerbated by climate change because we now have more significant storm events with more water, and I'm sure that the listeners will remember it was only last September that Marginal Way and other streets were completely flooded in Portland and very difficult to pass. So that's a really big task. And the other one, which I've alluded to, is climate change. And that takes into account all the whole gray area that we've talked about with just that climate change is everything. It's rising temperature, it's rising pH, it's a change in composition of organisms in the bay. There's so many different impacts on the bay caused by climate change that trying to get a handle on what's the new norm in the bay, how can we help the bay adapt, and how can we slow down some of the impacts of climate change. So those are the big issues, but the role has also changed, and I don't know if you want me to talk about how the role has changed as well from when my predecessor held the position.
Sure.
So I think when Joe Payne started, there was a really clear-cut problem. A report had come out indicating that Casco Bay was very unhealthy and that pollution from sewage was the primary issue. And Joe is a scientist, and he was really focused on collecting the science and working on starting to alleviate that problem, and the role kind of developed from there. By the time I'm on board, a lot more of the job deals with policy making and the regulatory process. The science is still critical. I'm still very much immersed in the science and work very closely with the scientists on our staff and scientists at other organizations. But more of my time is spent in the legislature or reviewing permits to make sure that the limits in the permits are sufficient to protect the bay, advocating for particular laws and looking at things at that kind of end of the spectrum.
And Mary, how about you? You've been doing this for a little while now. How has your role continued to evolve?
I think when I first started, it was 19 years ago now, I was more focused on just doing our publications and supporting Joe. I used to say I was his office wife because I would draft things for him and write policy papers for him. Ivy's really an amazing writer herself, so she doesn't need as much support. But also, as my interest areas grew, there was the fact that we have all this wonderful data, and I have worked with educators in the past, so I put together some curricula activities that used our data. Now that we're really focusing a lot on climate change, there's a lot of local data that I've incorporated into activities that kids can do to think about how climate change is affecting us locally, because one of our mottos is think local, act local. And also this Bayscaping program, even though almost everything we do is focused on the water, Bayscaping focuses on lawns, which seems to be kind of an oxymoron, but because of the impact of nitrogen fertilizers and pesticides, we realized we had to get people involved in thinking about how they use their properties. Even if they lived far up the watershed, it still comes down those rivers. So I've been able to build up different kinds of programs. But having Ivy on board, it's so cool. I love Joe, and he very much supported Ivy's hiring. But Ivy brings an energy and a whole new perspective, so it's almost like starting all over again. So it's very renewing. It's been a really great. Can it only be 2 months?
Well, I think listening to Mary too, it reminds me that when Joe started, he was the sole employee, and a team built over time behind him. So he was a waterkeeper, supposed to be the eyes, ears, and voice of the bay. And I am supposed to be the primary eyes, ears, and voice of the bay, but I'm just one of a team that's doing that at Friends of Casco Bay. So Mary has particular subject areas that she is a recognized expert. Bayscaping, pesticides are among those. Mike Doan has become a phenomenal public speaker, and he deals a lot with nutrients that are getting into the bay, like nitrogen, and the impacts of ocean acidification, and reporting on the data that our volunteer scientists have collected. So that's a difference too. Joe was trying to do it all himself because that's what the job was at the time, and I'm enmeshed in a very talented team, and we can tag team things. And I think that there's that creates a lot of excitement and motivation for all of us to do our jobs because we're doing it together. We're thinking out loud and we're working collaboratively.
How can people find out about Friends of Casco Bay and the Bayscaping program and all the other wonderful things that you're doing?
They can go to our website, which is cascobay.org. They can stop by our office, which actually is on the campus of Southern Maine Community College in South Portland. But we also are having a number of events. In the fall, we do this great film festival that we'll be advertising for November 12th. We're also putting together a plan called Nitrogen Nabbing, which is going to be on July 10th, where we're going to recruit 100 volunteers. A lot of them will need to be boaters to collect water for us that we're going to send off and have analyzed for nitrogen. So it's sort of a one-day citizen scientist event.
And I would also say Facebook is, we do probably more posts these days on Facebook, and I'm trying to keep up with Twitter, but it's not so much my thing. But I think a great way, if anybody is listening and wants to be involved, is to join us on July 10th. We already have a lot of people have expressed interest in being volunteers, but it should be a lot of fun, and the science from that day will be used to help the Maine Department of Environmental Protection set limits that can be used on how much nitrogen can be discharged in the bay. So it's an opportunity for in one morning, in a couple hours, to do something that will have a real impact for the state.
Well, I encourage people who are listening to find out more about the events you're describing and also Friends of Casco Bay. We've been speaking with Mary Cerullo, who is the Associate Director of Friends of Casco Bay, and also with Ivy Frignoca, who is the Casco Bay Keeper. It's really a pleasure to have you in here today. I appreciate all the work that you do.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.